Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Hannah Colton, a public health reporter here at KUNM. Early voting is underway in local elections, including for three seats on the Albuquerque School Board. Those board members control a massive budget and policies affecting more than 80,000 students, and they'll hire the next superintendent. Well, this morning we have in the studio five people who are vying for those school board seats. Our conversation will be framed by one of the biggest New Mexico education stories. A judge ruled last year that the state violated the law and has failed to provide adequate education to students learning English, Native American students, students with disabilities, and those from families with low incomes. With that in mind, what questions do you have for candidates this morning? What should APS do about disparities related to race, language access, class, and disability? If you have questions for the candidates this hour, you can call in as soon as possible. The number is 277-5866 or email letstalk@KUNM.org. First up, we have a candidate from District 2. That's the northwest part of Albuquerque, which includes Cibola and Volcano Vista High Schools. Lori Harris, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
The other candidate for District 2 is Peggy Mueller-Aragon, who holds that board seat today. She's the only candidate who did not respond to multiple requests to participate in this show. Lori, if you could introduce yourself, give us your age, occupation, or how you spend your time, and then the APS schools that you've been affiliated with.
Sure. My name is Lori Harris, and I'm a 59-year-old retired teacher, and I just retired recently in December. The school that I was last at is Jefferson Middle School, and before that I've also taught at Cibola High School and Truman Middle School and the Northwest Academy.
Thank you. So let's jump right in. During a community forum a few weeks ago, you told student organizers who were asking questions that you would support adding anti-racism bills to the APS legislative agenda. What kinds of anti-racism measures do you think are needed to ensure students of color get a good education at APS?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a lot of things we can do to make things better, like increasing multi-ethnic literature in our classrooms, different books that address these issues that help kids see what it's like to be in a different ethnic group. So I think we can also expand our K-12 ethnic studies curriculum to be part of our daily routines, not just a separate class. Maybe just listening to families and students more about what their needs are. I think sometimes we brush things under the rug because we're in such a hurry to meet our academic goals that we don't always listen appropriately.
And what trainings, books, conversations, or other resources have been helpful to you in learning about how racism and race-based inequities affect students of color in New Mexico? Like, what resources have you drawn on in your own life?
Well, when I first came to New Mexico in 1997, we were in the middle of another lawsuit where we had not been appropriately teaching students who had language issues. We were making too many of them into special education. So all teachers were trained at that time, and still are to this day, on how to scaffold and help children with language problems to learn in the best ways possible and to give them support.
What is that scaffold?
So rather than trying to just introduce a topic that might be totally foreign to a student who speaks a different language, that you would introduce it in a way so that they get background knowledge, that you would expect students who maybe some might already know about that situation or that topic, but by providing extra information to the students who speak a different language, or by providing them with visual help, or other kinds of resources.
So you're saying that the lawsuit at the time was educational for you,
right,
in letting you know?
Right.
Did you have anything else to say about that?
No.
So an APS parent, Victoria, who is Native American, sent us a question via Instagram this week.
Okay.
She asks, are you familiar with the New Mexico Indian Education Act? And what steps would you take as a board member to ensure the district complies with that state law?
That's a good question. That's not something I've researched or studied enough to give a really good answer on that. But I do know that I've run into, you know, in my 26 years, I've taught lots of diverse children, and I've learned a lot from them. And I would say that we need to listen to what struggles they're having and try to meet those needs.
Searchlight New Mexico, a news outlet, recently reported on APS's use of threat assessments. Those are evaluations meant to flag students who might commit mass shootings or other violence. The report found that special ed students and Black students were disproportionately targeted for those threat assessments, though mass school shootings are typically committed by white students. As a board member, what steps would you take to address the unfair criminalization of students of color and students with disabilities in APS?
I think what's happening from what I saw in the last, maybe say, decade of teaching, is that these groups of students that we're seeing now are much more open to social justice issues. They will stand up for themselves in ways, and maybe that's why some of these people that feel the most unfairly treated are sometimes the ones that are showing what we would consider behavior issues, but actually they're just trying to stand up for themselves. So I think we need to start asking more about why they're getting in trouble and what we can do to solve those issues for them. Because, like, for instance, I had a voter recently asked me how I felt about the students who went out for the gun violence issues. They left class, and I think that the voter was concerned that kids are leaving class to speak up for things that are important to them. But this group of students that we're currently working with, they're going to continue to do that. They are going to stand up, and they're going to say what they think. It's kind of a radical group of kids, and they're not going to put up with what they see as injustice. And so I think we just are going to have to really learn to deal with that and live with them with the way they are.
I hear you about, like, students who are involved in activist organizing. Mm-hmm. I want to reframe a question about students of color who have disabilities, because we know that those students are disproportionately likely to face harsh discipline, mm-hmm. That takes them out of the classroom, puts them in early contact with the criminal justice system. So if elected, what policies or budget priorities would you support to disrupt that school-to-prison pipeline?
Well, the work that's going on right now in our district with restorative justice is the correct direction. I'm not sure teachers are all bought into the whole idea of restorative justice practices, but that's probably, you know, we're talking about doing more professional development, more time spent training teachers so we can get them on board with those ideas and teach them the tricks and the tools that they need to not just rely on traditional discipline. We need some new ideas about that.
What is the sort of difference between, like, traditional discipline, as you say, and, like, restorative justice? Like, what aspects of that do you find important?
That's a great question, because I think a lot of people don't really understand that 100%. And it's really all about looking at what the kids, the reasons behind their problems, and not just telling them this is bad, don't do that again, but showing them that that in life, in the real world, we're going to have consequences that aren't about shaming somebody or aren't about telling you that you're bad. It's more about making up for what you did or learning the natural consequences of things.
Last question, Lori. Mm-hmm. At the community forum earlier this month, where most of these candidates were present, mm-hmm. you said you would not support giving 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote in school board elections. That was a question posed by the student organizers. Why do you not support that lowering the voting age for school board elections for students.
I just think that's a rite of passage with turning 18. And I think if we were going to do that, we should give them the right to vote in all elections. So I don't see the benefit of having two different voting age levels. So if we decide that they're capable enough to make these decisions at 16, then we should say they're capable of other things at 16 also. So I think it's either one or the other. But I would support, I mean, if that's the way we want to go, if we want to say 16 is the age of adulthood, you know, I would think about that more seriously. Yeah.
Lori Harris, candidate for the APS Board District 2 seat in Northwest Albuquerque. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Let's go to a quick break. Again, the number to call this morning if you have any questions for school board candidates is 277-5866. That's if you want to ask candidates a question related to educational equity this hour. You can also tweet with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We'll be back in a minute.
Support comes from not-for-profit Nusenda Credit Union, where Nusenda's Community Rewards Program benefits members and makes positive change statewide. Learn more at nusenda.org. Nusenda Credit Union, the power of we, insured by NCUA.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Representing Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, civil rights plaintiffs, and victims of sexual abuse. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
Dream of Wild Health is a Minnesota nonprofit dedicated to restoring the health of Native people. They grow fresh produce and work with a number of tribes, teaching the importance of traditional food and healthy eating. We'll hear more about the program on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Good morning. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. This morning, we are live with candidates for the Albuquerque School Board. Early voting has begun. Election day is November 5th. We've already heard from a candidate in Northwest Albuquerque, Lori Harris. Her opponent, the incumbent, Peggy Muller Aragon, was the only candidate who did not respond to KUNM's request to come on this show. Up next, we have two candidates from District 1. Yolanda Montoya Cordova. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And Madeline Jones. Before we dive in, I want to let listeners know there's still time to call in with your questions. We're keeping the conversation focused on equity today. We know that many students of color, differently abled students, and those from families with low incomes have not had a fair chance at getting a good education in our public schools. What do leaders in our state's largest district plan to do about that? What concerns do you have about those issues? Give us a call as soon as possible if you want to put a question to the candidates about equity. We've gotten some great questions via email and Twitter and Instagram. It's great. The number to call in, 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. We're also on Twitter. You can use the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. So going to the South Valley now, Yolanda and Madeline, your South Valley district includes Rio Grande High School and Atrisco Heritage Academy. Yolanda, you were appointed to the board in 2018.
That's correct.
So if you could each just briefly introduce yourself with your name, age, occupation, and schools that you've been affiliated with. Madeline, why don't you start?
Yes, my name is Madeline Jones. I am 79. My occupation is a business owner in Albuquerque for 44 years. APS schools, I graduated from Highland, attended a middle school that doesn't exist anymore called Monroe and La Mesa. Then I have spent over 50 years in the South Valley as raised my family there. All my kids went to South Valley schools.
Thank you. Yolanda?
Yes, good morning. Buenas tardes, or buenos dias, huh? It's morning. My name is Yolanda Montoya Cordova, and I'm 61 years old. I'm currently working as the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Workforce Solutions. I was appointed in January. And the schools that I'm really proud of, I'm a proud graduate of Rio Grande High School. I've spent all my life in the South Valley, so I grew up and went to all those schools. My late husband and my mother also worked for APS. My husband was a teacher with Highland High School, and my mother was an educational assistant with Ernie Pyle Middle School.
All right, thank you. So New Mexico public schools have a painful history of forcing students to assimilate into white English-speaking settler culture. And we know that still just a fraction of APS students from non-English-speaking families have their first language embedded in their schooling. So as a board member, what steps would you take to ensure that all students have access to bilingual, multicultural education? Madeline, why don't you take it first?
Actually, because of my age and because of the fact that I live in an area where I'm white and other people are not, I grew up and lived in a section where color's not really noticeable down there. We have the Indian population, we have Spanish population, we have white population. South Valley is like its own little town. Everybody's the same. We grew up that way. My kids grew up that way. So what's happening now in the school is a question to me as to why it happened in the first place.
So just the question is, what steps would you take to ensure that all students have access to bilingual multicultural education?
The question that I have is, why was that not part of the curriculum when my kids went to school down there? And is it just something new that has started? I don't understand where it even came from in the first place. And I am the mother of a handicapped child, a person who was born with tremendous birth defects and had to go through all of those schools. So we have been in programs at probably the worst, and that's those that have the worst disabilities. And we had to maneuver the school situation and guarding the special education to get my child what he needed. And we had it responsive, so I don't know why it's not responsive today. And because I'm outside of education, I don't know the details of how it got there.
All right. And Yolanda, same question. So thinking about the history that New Mexico schools have of assimilating students into English-speaking and white culture, as a board member, what steps would you take to ensure that students have access to bilingual and multicultural education?
You know, there's a lot of things that APS is already doing that I'd like to see continued. And those are, you know, the pieces that we're doing around ethnic studies. Obviously, we have small pieces of it. We need to grow that so that we have it into more schools. I'm really proud of our bilingual SEAL programs. And I like the fact that we're actually trying to increase the types and the numbers of languages that we're going to be making available. I think children can be biliterate in their family language, their cultural language. I, as a student, grew up with a family that spoke Spanish, and school didn't provide me an opportunity to do that. Yes, I could take Spanish classes, but there wasn't the cultural ethnic studies that was associated with that. And when I went to UNM and took my first Chicano studies courses, I remember being extremely enlightened about that, and I wish that that had been something that had happened to me when I was a student, because I would have had a better understanding, a better sense of pride of where my family was. Yes, we live in the South Valley. It's a very multicultural community, and that cultural piece of how we live as a multicultural community needs to be represented in the classroom. So I like seeing our students having access to ethnic studies. I like the fact that we're going to promote more New Mexico history that's inclusive history, so that we can talk about our Native American brothers and sisters as well as our Latino families that have been part of the community forever.
And students of color who have disabilities are disproportionately likely to face harsh discipline. We've seen reporting about suspensions, use of force in schools, and that discipline takes them out of the classroom, puts them into early contact with the criminal justice system. If elected, what policies or budget priorities would you support, Madeline, to disrupt that school-to-prison pipeline and to treat students with disabilities and students of color with respect?
Because I'm outside of the educational sphere, I see things completely different. I think that our problem is that we don't see the students as children, period. Not black, not white. They're children. And all children come with a certain package of who they are, what they do, and how they do it. And we don't even now keep them as they're the same. And therefore, we keep splitting them into all these different groups, saying that you have this, you have that, instead of just treating them as children needing an education and treating them in education, period.
Thank you. And Yolanda, what policies or budget priorities would you support to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline?
I think there are a lot of things that we could do in schools. I know with my background in child welfare and juvenile justice, I've been really concerned about the number of children of color that end up in, that our system impacted. And a lot of the things that we could have done to address that would have been things like making school-based health centers available so that we'd have access to more mental health, more training for our teachers on ACEs and trauma-informed approaches and practices or restorative justice practices as well. I think it's really critical that, you know, that lens is there, that truth lies there when we look at the data and we see the number of children that are specifically part of like juvenile justice, when we look at the number of kids and boys of color and kids with disabilities that end up through that system, we need to ask ourselves why. And I think we need to go back and we need to think about how did the school impact that as well. I think there are things that we could do to curb that tide. And again, it's things through, you know, supportive services, mental health services, and then just that opportunity for us to really truly understand the makeup of the families that we're serving and the impacts that it's having for these children as they're trying to integrate into school. But it's also important that we focus on professional development with our teachers. I think our staff and all teachers, school principals, everyone needs to be aware of what those children come with and what the needs are so that we can address those effectively.
Thank you for that. And we have a caller, Melissa, calling from South Valley. Melissa, you are on air. What would you like to ask the candidates?
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for calling.
I live in the South Valley, and sometimes our schools are marginalized by the media. I'd like to know why the candidates think this is happening and how, as a board member, they will address this.
So South Valley schools being marginalized in the media, Madeline, why do you think that's happening and what do you want to do to address it?
Well, one of the things that keeps happening is that the more that you talk about differences instead of what is the same, then you start putting people into these cubby holes. And the South Valley has the reputation of being the place where crime is and everything that's bad is in the South Valley. And that is not the case. So it's a lesson that has to be taught to everyone that this differences are not the problem. The problem is that from the time that a child is born, they're in a family. And the family is the cohesiveness of what that child is going to be. And if the families have problems, then the child is going to have problems. And that's where we need to start. But the media is just reacting to what is in our society today, which is a very high crime rate.
And I do want to remind our candidates that, you know, a judge ruled last year that students are getting unequal education. And so, you know, there is blame held by the school system and statewide. Right. Yolanda, did you want to take that question as well?
Sure. You know, and Melissa, thank you so much for that question. I remember growing up in the South Valley and always feeling marginalized because I was from the South Valley. When I went to UNM, I remember people almost being apologetic that I had graduated from Rio Grande. And it was, you know, it was definitely a mind meld. I mean, I remember feeling somewhat self-conscious about that. But, you know, the South Valley is a great community. It's a beautiful community. And there's a lot of there's a lot of new activity that's going on there. As a board member, you know, as I've been sitting on the board, I've really tried to bring to light all of the strengths and the resilience of the South Valley, taking into account the fact that we've got, you know, one of the largest high schools, that we've got some of the largest number of students that are actually participating in the biliteracy program, and students that are coming out with that seal is really incredible and important to me. I've also have celebrated with our schools and our district around some of the schools that we have in this community, like Los Padillas, actually pulling itself out of that MRI status and doing the things that they've done to engage the community. The South Valley has some incredible community schools, and so we're starting to bring our community together and engaging with the community and parents so that they can be part of the schools. And what I want to do with the media is I want them to pay attention to that and look at that so that, you know, we have like a South Valley corner and we can say, yes, the South Valley is celebrated. It's a great community.
Thanks for that. I do want to add, as a journalist, oftentimes when I request access from the APS communications director, I get blocked at every turn. So, you know, it's something,
a board member.
It's something that I'm interested as a journalist, but as, you know, as a member of the public and representing schools to the public as well. Melissa, thank you so much for that question. Let's go to another listener question. Todd has called in from Albuquerque. Good morning, Todd. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. My question is, we're new to Albuquerque. We're both educators, my spouse and I. My spouse is an educator of color. And one thing that we hear a lot about is pay inequality for teachers in APS and the significant need for educators that are needed. But quite frankly, we can't afford to be teachers in Albuquerque, given the cost of daycare. And so I'm curious as to what the board member candidates are looking at to address that, particularly if we're looking at equity with students and students of color to be able to hire an educator of color, bilingual, but we really can't make that leap financially.
Thank you so much for that question, Todd. And Yolanda, do you want to start on this one?
Sure. You know, Todd, thank you so much. I agree with that question. You know, up until this last year, the pay for our teachers in public schools was really terrible. There's no doubt. My late husband was a teacher for 20 plus years with Highland High School. And God, we used to look at that paycheck and used to drive me insane because we just had, you know, two different, we both had master's degrees. And yet my pay was different than his. I'm really grateful that at this last legislative session that there was the pay increase that was put into place for teachers, and we moved up the tiers. I'm hoping that that gets us there. I think more still needs to be done. I know for our teachers who go out for that TESOL endorsement or those other...
And that's the, teaching English as a second language.
Thank you. Yes. I'm sorry. I shouldn't talk in acronyms. I would have probably blown that anyway. But yes, you know, teaching our kids of color and for our teachers who want to come in and especially work maybe in districts that have higher need or even like special ed endorsements, I think we need to consider that as well. I definitely am supportive of needing to create that balance in our teaching groups as well. I'd love to see more teachers of color, definitely. I think it matters that you get to see someone who's like you, and I think we need to figure out how we can get there and get that done much more better than we are now.
Madeline Jones, what are your thoughts on how to make it financially feasible for teachers of color to keep those jobs?
You know, this question is kind of timely, considering what happened with the superintendent and what the superintendent got out of the APS, leaving teachers behind. Everyone knows that she got way too much money, and now she's leaving. So this idea of teachers and their money that they get, the teachers are professionals, and they are not recognized as professionals. They are not at the top of the list when something is being decided. They are not at the top of the list when the money is being distributed. And yet, the only people that really do the work are the teachers. The students and the teachers are what should come first. And the idea on, and if this is not the board's fault, I have got to tell you this, it is not the board's fault. The board has been given a box to fit in. And they don't really have that much to say about anything or to fix it. And so these questions are very difficult for a board member because there's only so much that they can do outside of what's already been presented by somebody else. And the money is really at the top of the list in terms of how are we going to get teachers. Right now, there's not even people going to school to be teachers. We're going to have shortages for a very long time. As I said, I'm a business person. I look at that. Not going to be any good to give our teachers more money if there's not any teachers to give it to. So we have a lot of problems there.
All right. Last question comes from a listener. How would you address widespread marginalization of Indigenous students in APS schools? Yolanda.
I think, one, we need to take a real serious look at that Indian Education Act. It's never been fully funded. We have to own up to that, and I think that's what the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit is telling us to do. Through the legislative session, this last session, they did give money back into the schools. It helped us to fund those educator pay raises, plus the pay raises for the other people that also work really hard in the schools. I want to tell you, those educational assistants are really critical. My mother was one of those and worked with students with disabilities and was really critically needed. But the marginalization there of our Indigenous population, it solely rests in the fact that Indian Education Act has never been fully funded, that we've never really have had a way of bringing curriculum into the schools that's really focused on our Indian population and really recognizing and acknowledging that we're sitting on Native land. This is about our Native American brothers and sisters, and we need to figure out how we're also making them feel... We should start with them. They're the Indigenous people first, and this is their country. This is their land. And how do we make them feel that, you know, all the way from artifacts in schools to the way that we name schools, so that we can make sure that we're not marginalizing this population any more than we need to. I want to celebrate the cultural differences that we have. I want to celebrate the beauty of that Native American culture. My background, my family is from Isleta Pueblo, and because we were never really part of that, I felt like I really missed a lot of that. And I'm learning a whole lot more as I've been on the board, and I think that's an area that we need to improve on.
Madeline, what, as a board member, what would you do to address marginalization of Indigenous students across APS?
Considering that I'm a business owner, and we hire everybody, whether they're Indian, whether they're Black, whether they're Asian, and we don't look at them that way, maybe that really is the problem. Every child needs to learn how to read, whether they're Indian or whether they're white. Doesn't make any difference. They need to know how to read. And if they know how to read, then they will know how to see things around them differently. Maybe they see themselves as less. And never, never, never is any child less. And so maybe we need to teach the children that they're just the same as everybody else.
The number to call in this morning, 277-5866. If you have a question for school board candidates, that's 277-5866. Let's go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM.
Halloween has spooky skeletons, and Day of the Dead honors our loved ones who have died. This week on the Children's Hour, we explore how kids cope with grief. The Kids Crew interview friends from the Children's Grief Center of New Mexico and children's book Evan and the Sky Goats author Vanessa Vassar. Plus, we talk with death expert Gail Rubin.
It's all in an hour.
The Children's Hour. Kids Public Radio.
Live and local Saturdays 9 to 10 a.m. on KUNM.
As debates about immigration escalated in 2017, composer Valerie Coleman wrote this piece of music. She calls it an immigrant's anthem, a declaration of a person's right to exist and to dream the American dream. We'll hear A Right to Be by Valerie Coleman on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm your host, Hannah Colton. This morning, we're talking with candidates for the upcoming Albuquerque School Board election. A reminder, early voting is underway. We've just heard from candidates hoping to represent the northwest part of Albuquerque and the South Valley. Next up are the candidates from southeast Albuquerque, incumbent Barbara Peterson and challenger Verland Coker. Thank you for being here, both of you.
Good to be here.
How do you think school district leaders should respond to unequal education based on students' race, ability, class, and language? If you still want to get a question into candidates, give us a call in the next few minutes. The number to call is 277-5866. Again, that's 277-5866. So Verland, Barbara, you're running to represent the district that includes Nob Hill and the International District. If you could introduce yourself. Let's start with Verland.
Hi, my name is Verland Coker. I'm 26. I only work like 12 hours a week at a Pizza Hut, so not quite employed as much as I'd like to be. I am a high school dropout from Highland High School, and I did drop out for a little bit at Wilson Middle School as well.
All right, thanks. And Barb?
I'm Barbara Peterson. I'm 67. I retired in 2012 after 35 years working for APS, and the schools that I worked in, interestingly enough, Cortez Elementary, which is now Freedom High, and Acoma Elementary, which is now Papa, and I was an EA when I started in early childhood, then moved on to the South Valley, worked at Larrazolo, which is now a community center, and Valle Vista for 30 years, which is a dual language elementary school in the South Valley. Worked as everything from kindergarten teacher to fifth grade teacher, reading intervention, reading recovery, and instructional coach. And then my daughter, I got to experience APS as a parent, which I think really helped my understanding of issues that parents feel, the community feels. It really deepened my understanding of the relationship between teacher and family when my daughter was at Valle Vista with me and then at Jefferson and Albuquerque High.
Well, thank you. Let's take a listener question. Frank is on the line from Albuquerque. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Go right ahead with your question.
Okay. My question is this. Again, I guess asking me if my question is this. Does anything really even matter when it comes down to loving our children, no matter where we live at, what color we are? And excluding the politics, I know it's a political kind of a bias or non-bias conversation this morning, but what I wanted to say is, and I guess it's more of a statement than the question, is where do the funds go? Because the federal funding is, again, I'm not going to open up the box, but my son has autism. And I grew up in the North Valley, and I now reside in the South Valley. I'm trying to give hope for people out there in regards to just hope, period, because crime and addiction and all the above is going to be in every element in every city, state, county, north, south, east, west, valleys. So I guess my question is this. What do we do to make a change? How do we break the chains and build bridges?
So I hear you saying your son has autism. Maybe the candidates can respond to that specifically as far as how do we make sure that students with disabilities get what they need in all schools across all of APS, as Frank was saying. Verland, would you like to start?
Sure. Well, for special education, I've been involved with a lot of activists who specifically work for this. What I've found is that a lot of what we are doing in special education has to deal with focusing on diagnoses. And what happens with that is you don't actually look for what the gifts these students have. And this is more exemplary in the twice exceptional students who are both in special needs but also gifted. And they're one of the most marginalized students that we have. And I do want to sort of at least acknowledge the whole question from the caller, because like my mom, when she was training to be a teacher and going to college as a teacher, one of the things that she wanted to have was as a part of the resolution for teachers was to have a love for the students. And that was something that a lot of her peers and the administration and all the schools that we went to that just could not understand. And it's something that's been sorely missing in a lot of our pipelines for getting teachers in the classroom.
Thanks for that. Barb?
So I always end up starting backwards and stepping back from questions like that because there are so many layers to it. One is that we need to go back to solid early childhood education. And that means giving kindergarten children, as they walk in the door, a connection with their family. We used to do home visits and listen to what parents really wanted for children. And then having a curriculum in kindergarten that opened up the world, that was rich in their language as much as possible, first language, literacy, exploration, and play. And we know that children learn to play. And we've set up a structure in lots of classrooms where children aren't allowed to be children. And so I think one of the first steps is to address what happens in our curriculum for young children and how do we integrate everything from ethnic studies to restorative practices to just learning how to talk to each other at early stages. And that's been taken out to a great extent. And it makes it even harder for children as they grow. But the other thing is funding is a very real thing. Right now, New Mexico is funded at about 13% from the feds, when the promise with the IDEA was for 40% funding. And so when we look at Yazzie Martinez and what's happening with federal funding, whether it's Title I or IDEA funding, it does make a difference. And when we are sufficiently funded, we can see that teachers have the time to talk to each other and collaborate and think about their children, and children have the resources they need.
So APS students have said they often have teachers and curricula that fail to incorporate Indigenous histories, languages, or ways of knowing. What steps would you take to ensure that Native American students get what they need to succeed in APS schools? Barb?
I think previous discussion has covered a lot of that, and I'll just give a nod to some of the things that have been already said. Children are different. Children come in the door with different assets and backgrounds, and we need to approach it out of respect for who are you when you first walk in the door, and do you see yourself in the curriculum? Is it respected as much as possible? Is your language recognized and respected? That we need to build on those strengths because they are strengths. When it comes to purchasing, for instance, materials, making sure that instructional materials are diverse. We just recently went through the adoption of social science materials, civics books, history books. And it's a little appalling to see how little has changed since 50 years ago in what those textbooks look like. So one of the things that we need to do is give teachers, and especially those master ethnic studies teachers, the ability to have resources to purchase the materials that they know will respond to who's in their classroom and who our community is, what our real history is. So there are lots of second source. There are lots of materials that we need to make sure we give teachers the opportunity to build. The other part is professional development. And lots of times we see professional development as top-down, one hit, here's what you're supposed to do, and no chance to deal with that with colleagues and to really explore ideas. What does that mean in the classroom? How do I respond to children? How's my curriculum? How's my teaching reflecting the children in my room? And so giving teachers that opportunity is essential.
Thanks. And Verland, what steps would you take as a board member to ensure that Native American students get what they need in schools?
Okay. Well, first of all, some contextualization. I myself am Native American, and I speak both from experience in high school and in college as well. I had an issue at Institute for American Indian Arts over a racist textbook as well. Well, it was racist material. But one thing I do want to make sure that everyone sort of understands is that every single candidate hears is overall inadequate in understanding what the actual issue is in terms of Native American representation in the curriculum. The New Mexico standards themselves for social studies for a large section of the grades is woefully inadequate. There isn't a single mention of even the word genocide or even dealing with, say, the boarding school issue or anything to deal with that. They phrase the participation of Native Americans in the American Civil War, or not the American Civil War, but the American Revolution, as what was the you know, core ideals that they shared with the American people, which was, you know, land rights and freedom of religion, which were things that the American people were actively infringing on. And this is something that has to deal with APS saying to NMPED that this is an inadequate, that this is part of the reason why the Martinez-Yazzie case happened in the first place. And we're talking about textbooks. We shouldn't even be having textbooks as a requirement. Sure, we can have some in the classroom because they are useful from time to time, but they're kind of a waste of money as we have them required. We should be shifting into open educational resources, which allows for more diverse ways to do it. And it's not entirely free. It's how I've gotten my entire education. And it's something that we need to be looking at a little more broader, and that it is a part of the overall crisis in education.
Thanks for that. We have a caller, Ellen, on the line from Albuquerque. Go ahead with your question, Ellen.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. I'm just curious, how does this all fit in for the blind community? Only because of the fact that I know that a small percentage of the blind community are not getting the instruction in Braille and other stuff that they need because of all the mainstreaming from the blind schools and stuff like that. So I'm just curious, how is that fitting as far as for the blind community getting the education that they need?
Thanks so much for calling, Ellen. Berland, go ahead.
That is a really good question. There's not a lot of focus on the classical disabilities, as it were. I know a lot of my friends went into from high school went into ESL or ASL. I'm sorry,
American Sign Language.
Yes, American Sign Language, and we don't really deal with these sort of disabilities in a way that I think is inclusive to the classroom. It sort of does link back to the textbook thing, because if we had textbooks as a non-requirement to open educational resources, a lot of that money that goes to procurement of textbooks could then go to procurement of materials for the blind, and that's where all the Braille would come in, and that's a very easy like budget solution. And that's just sort of like step one. The ideal goal would be to have projects in the classroom for project-based learning, 21st century education, that can involve students with these disabilities without, you know, excluding them. Because a lot of what happens in the classroom is we sort of section these students off instead of actually integrating them into the rest of the classroom with their friends and everyone. And that's one of the biggest issues with how we deal with inclusion overall, regardless of race or disability. And a lot of it has to deal with just the way that we are teaching education in general. All of it's based off of memorization and regurgitation, and that doesn't really help anybody, especially those with these disabilities who really need to develop the skills that they need to actively work in, at very least in the workforce, or to have a fulfilling life in general.
Barb?
Sorry,
a reminder. The question is about children who are blind and what the blind community needs an APS.
Right. Yeah. I would really be interested in sitting down with the caller and talking more, because what I found in talking with a variety of people from the community is that whether it's in the visually impaired community, whether it's in the hearing impaired community, whether it's in any other aspect, there's not one idea of what the right approach is. And so I think the challenge for APS is to figure out how to meet needs as seen by a family for a child. And it's a challenge, because I know in the hearing impaired community, for instance, there are people who strongly believe in using American Sign. There are people who believe equally strongly in integration and other kinds of accommodations. So it's a real challenge for a district. How do we open it up and listen to the variety of the spectrum of needs? When I was teaching, some of the best, most satisfying teaching I ever did was in an inclusion classroom where I teamed with a special ed teacher. And really working through, how do we make sure that what we're teaching is accessible to everyone? How do we make sure that the real particular needs of individual students are met and at the same time create a community and an environment that pulls everyone in and lets everyone develop the relationship with each other? And again, I think a lot of it means going back to having time for teachers and schools to listen to families, time for teachers to listen to children as individual, and time to work with each other as colleagues for how we meet those needs.
So a recent investigation by the news outlet Searchlight New Mexico found that APS has been lying to federal regulators about its use of restraint and seclusion, practices that frequently traumatize students with disabilities. As a board member, what would you do to ensure that students with disabilities are safe and respected in schools? And we are getting closer to the end of the hour, so I think we'll do a minute per answer here. Barb?
So I can't answer to that. As you can tell, it's probably going to be a legal issue. I have no idea of the specific circumstances. I know APS as a whole has a very good policy on restraint and seclusion. I think adequate staffing, adequate professional development is absolutely essential. And again, being able to have the time to think about how are we meeting kids' needs. Because I also, on the other side of it, I hear from parents who are saying, my child's class was removed from the class and is missing instructional time because of how volatile some children are. And so clearly, we have a responsibility as a district to meet the needs of the whole spectrum of children, whether it's the most fragile, volatile child or the child that comes in ready to go academically. And that takes staffing and it takes professional development.
Verland, steps you would take to address these restraint and seclusion practices and keep students with disabilities safe?
Right. I was actually recently at a event hosted by Searchlight New Mexico, and I think Yolanda was also there. So, I mean, at least someone's here is doing their job. But one of the things that they sort of address is that the seclusion and restraint issue is sort of an after-the-fact kind of thing. Like, if you're at that point, it's already too late that you've already messed up doing your job as a special education teacher. And the reason that all of this sort of interlinks together with what I'm trying to push education towards, which is 21st century education, is that a lot of it was about addressing a frustration. Like the pipeline is that there's an expectation that they need to meet, student needs to meet. They can't meet it. And the way that they communicate that is different. For special needs students, that usually means that they act out. And when you focus on what expectation they're supposed to meet and why the expectation shouldn't be expected or the, you know, viability of the expectation, it bypass the entirety of that punishment system of that physical restraint.
Thank you for that. We are out of time for today, unfortunately. We had so many good listener calls. Thank you to all of you who sent in questions and who called in this morning. Thank you to the school board candidates who came in. That's Lori Harris, Yolanda Montoya-Cordova, Madeline Jones, Verland Coker, and Barb Peterson. A reminder, early voting is underway. This year, you can even register and vote on the same day during the early voting period. There are details on our website, kunm.org. Election day is November 5th. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen on kunm.org or subscribe to our Let's Talk New Mexico podcast on your podcast app. The conversation doesn't have to end here. You can comment on our Facebook page, on Twitter with the hashtag Let's Talk NM, or email us at any time, letstalk@kunm.org. Our engineer this morning is John Strader. Our producer is Marisa DeMarco. Taylor Velasquez screened your calls. Kaveh Movahed live tweeted today's show, and Bryce Dix ran the video live stream. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Hannah Colton. Thank you for listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.